Sweet Internet, hello again. This is your host, John Wayne Bosky, co-chair of the Senate Select Committee of your heart. Yeah, that doesn't have the same ring to it. Anyway, back from D.C., it's time for what happened this week. Thanks for joining us. Appropriately enough, we begin tonight talking about Bethesda, who've gotten all weird on me in the past couple weeks. You saw the news on Game Informer about The Elder Scrolls Online, the MMO set in Bethesda's homegrown Elder Scrolls universe. We could talk about the few plot details we have, how it's about 1,000 years before the events in Skyrim, which in itself was a couple centuries after Morrowind and Oblivion, so with Elder Scrolls you can pretty much jump around anywhere you want in time and the game doesn't change much. We could talk about that, or I could stop dancing around the subject and just say that when I heard this news, my reaction was one of In case that didn't make it clear, I am not a fan of this turn of events, no sir. Look, the Mamorpgr genre is kind of in a tenuous position right now. World of Warcraft might be losing subscribers, but it's still the 800-pound gorilla and it could be years before that changes. BioWare made an expensive gambit with the Old Republic, but at best it's one of the more prominent also-rans. THQ is actually turning Warhammer Dark Millennium into a single-player game from its intended MMO position, which to my knowledge is the first time that has ever happened. There is ongoing debate over whether the subscription model is even sustainable. I think it can be with the right game, but you can't deny that free-to-play seems like a safer option right now. Long story short, it's a crowded field, times are changing, and there's no guarantee you'll pull in the megabucks, which you'll need to make an Elder Scrolls game. Leaving that mess aside, one of the big appeals of Elder Scrolls is you have a giganto-huge world to mess around in without the hassle of other people. How fun could running around stealing pants off people be if some other knob beats you to the punch? And what about modding? Don't lie to yourselves, ZeniMax, that's a big reason these games sell so well. And let's be clear, this is one of ZeniMax's studios doing the development. Bethesda is just publishing. You take out the modding, you take out the privacy, you add in the hassles that come with developing persistent online worlds, and I'm just not seeing a happy ending to this. Maybe I'll be wrong, who knows? Maybe I'll win the lottery tomorrow. And maybe in my lifetime we'll develop space travel, and cat girls, and robot maids, and you can live a good life on the off-world colonies. But I'm not betting on it. Now there was another interesting Bethesda tidbit that had nothing at all to do with the Elder Scrolls. Shinji Mikami, you may remember him as the creator of Resident Evils 1 through 4, also one of the people responsible for God Hand and Vanquish. Both excellent games, quite underrated. Anyway, Mikami's got a new studio, Tango Gameworks, and he's working on a survival horror game codenamed Project Zwei, German for the number 2. Joystick reports that Bethesda is the publisher backing the project, and Mikami indicates it's going to draw on his past work with the Resident Evil series. This, my friends, is the kind of news that makes me positively giddy. I've been itching for a callback to classic survival horror, and if anybody's equipped to do just that, it's one of the guys that invented it. Of course, it could skew towards the more action-y Resident Evil 4, but they specified survival horror, so I'll dare to dream for just this moment. In any case, this is going to be one to watch. Next up, we've got some financial talk. You may recall that, once upon a time last year, I suspected LinkedIn was part of a trio of overvalued tech stocks, one that more or less would serve as bellwethers for a tech bubble, the other two being Groupon and Zynga. As it turns out, LinkedIn has actually done quite well for itself. It's been sitting north of $100 a share for quite some time, and actually closed at 117.3 on Friday. I underestimated it. It's reliably pulled in good earnings and, unless I'm missing something, hasn't made any expensive acquisitions or suffered any internal drama. It was my first major guess, and while I was right to be suspicious of Groupon and Zynga, I was wrong about LinkedIn. For that, I apologize. Having said that, a recent Forbes article strengthens my suspicion that the real tech trouble trio is, in fact, Groupon, Zynga, and Facebook. Companies grossly overvalued, going public at the peak of their popularity, with few reliable growth prospects going forward. The article, titled How Zynga, Facebook, and Groupon's Go-To Auditor Rewrites Accounting Rules, talks about the accounting firm Ernst & Young, who specialize in technology and social media, pretty much wrote the book on accounting for virtual goods, for which there are no formal guidelines from the Securities and Exchange Commission or any other official organization. Now, because of the likes of Enron and Arthur Andersen, an accounting firm can't simultaneously audit a public company while offering them consulting services. That's a blatant conflict of interest. But there is nothing to prevent an accounting firm from doing one first, then the other later. That is, consulting work first, then later auditing the company as they prepare to go public, in which case it may literally be checking its own work. Quoting the article, Facebook, Zynga, and Groupon wouldn't say what consulting E&Y did for them before becoming their auditor, and you won't find it in the SEC filings. It doesn't ever have to be disclosed. The situation does not instill confidence that a fresh set of eyes have looked at the numbers, says former SEC chief accountant Lynn Turner. End quote. It goes into further detail about how Zynga records its revenue. Basically, the accounting time frame gets weird when you're talking virtual goods, and E&Y can more or less make up the rules as it goes, which potentially affects stock prices. Then you have bookings, which include contracts and goods that Zynga has sold but technically hasn't received money for yet. The company rather publicly announces they use this figure, which is a known way of overstating how much money you make. The bottom line is, social media companies have very flexible accounting practices and thus have an even greater need for an independent company to make sure their paperwork's on the up and up. These big three all go to the same company, Ernst & Young, who offers to consult them, then later comes back to check their work. Oh, and in case you want more reasons to be scared, chief accounting officers at Facebook and Zynga used to be on staff at Ernst & Young. A major financial institution was once in a similar position, their CFO a former partner with Ernst & Young, who was auditing them when the financial crisis hit. Its name? Lehman Brothers. Yeah. Tech stocks are in good hands. And just so I'm not singling out these companies, I'd like to mention Gree, G-R-E-E, another social games company based out of Japan. It's always social game companies lately. It's like they're compensating for something. Anyway, Gree plunked down $210 million to pick up a US mobile startup called Funzio. According to Develop Online, Funzio is a San Francisco-based company behind such titles as Crime City, Modern War, and Kingdom Age for Facebook and iOS, and Gree picked them up to expand its range of mid-core titles for social gaming platforms. Quoting the article, the buyout of Funzio follows the acquisition of firms such as OpenFaint, opening a Canada-based studio, and attempting to purchase draw-something developer OMG Pop, end quote. Well, now we know who else wanted a piece of the draw-something action. Draw Something, by the way, lost about 5 million daily active users since being picked up by Zynga, so for Gree, that's like dodging one bullet, then standing in the open so the guy shooting at you can try again. In other news, Eurogamer ran a lengthy feature this past week on Free Radical, the studio best known for the TimeSplitter series. Its members, David Doak, Steve Ellis, Carl Hilton, and others, had previously worked for Rare and developed both GoldenEye and Perfect Dark before splitting off to form Free Radical. More recently, they suffered the debacle that was Haze and had to shut down in 2008, being picked up by Crytek the next year and resurfacing as Crytek UK. Long and bumpy road for them, but I had little idea how long and how bumpy until I started reading this. The article starts with the question of whether Haze was responsible for Free Radical shutting down, and the answer is that it's a wee bit more complicated. Doak and his team split off from Rare during development of Perfect Dark, founding Free Radical and went on to start work on a title called Redemption. While they were developing this, Ellis had put together a first-person shooter engine that would be the basis for TimeSplitters. They cut it close, but were able to pull it off in time for the PS2 launch lineup. Eidos came back to them, wanting a sequel, which, with a larger team, they delivered in 2002. Both games, TimeSplitters 1 and 2, got good to great reviews and were modest commercial successes, but weren't really breakout hits the way GoldenEye had been. Redemption got renamed to Second Sight, and by the time it entered full production, the project changed hands from Eidos to Activision. Q Bobby Kotick going crazy in November 2003 and deciding they didn't like UK development, external development, or developer-owned IP. And Free Radical was all three of those things. Activision dropped about 10 projects, put several companies out of business, and Free Radical ultimately took Second Sight over to Codemasters. They weren't doing so hot either, so the title didn't have a real marketing push. Not to mention the same year it was released, 2004, was the year a very similar game also launched, PsyOps, the Mindgate Conspiracy. Both third-person action games with a mix of gunplay and psychic powers. As Doak says, it was unfortunately timed. I mean, what are the chances of people making two Asteroids Hit the Earth movies in 1 year? Must be a million to one. But there you are. And PsyOps came out at around the same time, and that blew our US sales out of the water. Their next TimeSplitters game, Future Perfect, got basically no marketing help, because EA, their publisher, wanted to put their money towards GoldenEye, Rogue Agent, which tanked, by the way, and Future Perfect didn't do much better. And then, of course, there's Haze, which came at the start of the current generation, right about when game budgets started exploding, for some mysterious reason, higher technology requirements. Publishers were getting more conservative, and people were less receptive to games that weren't military first-person shooters. The engine got replaced during development, leading to several delays, and the PS3 exclusivity agreement was inked before they actually had it working on the PS3. It's just a technical nightmare. The game's utter mediocrity combined with no marketing help killed it stone cold. Now keep in mind, throughout all this, the Free Radical team is working themselves to death on these projects. Unrealistic deadlines, uncooperative software, little financial success, and no way to reward the staff and keep morale high, just one thing after another. Eventually, LucasArts brought them in to work on Star Wars Battlefront 3, but that game would never see the light of day. In 2008, LucasArts got a new president and began a lot of cost-cutting measures that included rather cruel stalling tactics, refusing to pass development milestones due to nitpicks, forcing staff cuts after hires that LucasArts themselves had insisted upon, flat-out not paying Free Radical because of the milestones LucasArts refused to acknowledge, that kind of thing. It's frankly monstrous. Doak had this to say later on. My role at Free Radical meant that I was simultaneously involved in these unpleasant, high-level discussions with psychopaths who wanted to destroy us, and then the next day sitting down with our dev staff at their desks trying to boost people's morale, helping them to pass milestones that I knew would be subsequently manipulated to cause them to fail. It was the most depressing and pointless thing that I had ever been involved in. The dream job, which I had once loved, had become a nightmarish torture. The rest, sadly, is history. Free Radical went into administration, the team mostly disbanded, Crytek picked up the pieces. Carl Hilton and Graham Norgate stayed on with Crytek UK. Steve Ellis, Martin Wakely founded the studio Crash Lab. Derek Littlewood, Eggbox Interactive. Lee Ray freelances, and David Doak remains outside the industry. It's a sad end for a lot of legitimately talented people, and a sobering reminder of just how flat-out ugly the sausage-making process of games development can be. Now, I've argued against the caricature of publishers as Monopoly-style villains, but Free Radical died painfully, and a lot of publishers have blood on their hands. It's a fascinating story, but a disgusting one. With that large topic behind us, there are a bunch of smaller things worth bringing up, starting with this Engadget article about Nvidia's latest graphics card, the GeForce GTX 690, loaded with dual Kepler GPUs and clocking in at a scale-breaking $1,000. Nvidia claims it'll run Crysis 2 on ultra settings at a smooth 57.8 frames per second, which is funny because Crysis 2 is less demanding than Crysis 1. But come on, $1,000? I just plunked down a couple hundred for a GTX 570 myself, but I had been running a 465, and it could easily handle most modern games without so much as a hiccup. Yes, including Crysis 2. I thought the PC hardware wars were over. Lord knows Nvidia doesn't have much in the way of real competition these days. It's getting to the point where even hardcore graphics enthusiasts can't keep up, and they're seeing diminishing returns for increasing amounts of money. Who are they marketing this gizmo for? What games are coming out that modern computers are having trouble running? I thought we were hitting some kind of end state where graphics technology would level off and thus the hardware escalation would end. But no, they just keep cranking these things out. It's irritating. Sexy, but irritating. I also see Black Ops 2 got announced, no surprise there. In fact, it's so not surprising I'm gonna forego comment, even though I actually liked Black Ops, more than Modern Warfare to be honest, and go on to this much more amusing story. According to Kotaku, I know, take it with a grain of salt. According to Kotaku, China is apparently developing a homegrown console called the CT510 through developer Beijing Edu Technology. The price tag? $600. It will feature Kinect-style motion control, come pre-installed with 8 games, I can't wait to hear which ones, and will somehow bypass China's ban on game consoles. Mind you, existing consoles are sold throughout China on the gray market, so it's not like it won't have competition. No doubt this thing will feature all the best technology to combat piracy, namely by being completely laughable in every respect and thus not worth a pirate's time. In fact, let's go ahead and call this thing the N-Gage 2, or even put it on the level of the Phantom until proven otherwise. Remember the Phantom? Of course you don't. Next up, Blues News reports that FilePlanet, GameSpy's erstwhile haven of all things patch and demo related, is headed for internet dormancy. On FilePlanet itself, you're greeted with a red banner that reads, Note, FilePlanet is no longer being updated and is in the process of being archived. That's right, kids. Once upon a time, games did not update themselves automatically. We actually had to go to websites to download patches, and even click them ourselves. Some sites even convinced people to pay extra for the privilege, and we had to go uphill both ways in the snow, and the alphabet had only 7 letters in it, and Pittsburgh wasn't a state, and we liked it that way. You know, as fun as it is to watch the old guard of the internet fade away, it's also kind of sobering. I mean, just wait until we have a replacement for GameFAQs. Oh, wait a minute, games have their own Wikia sites now. Whoa-oh. Oh, God, I'm getting old. Next, we've got Sony Smash Brothers. Sorry, PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale. Gonna love watching the gaming press dance around the obvious Smash Brothers comparison. Nothing else to add there, so let's move to this instead. Electronic Arts is asking for feedback on Origin. Yes, on their official website, they're continuing the Origin conversation, asking people for what they like and dislike about their young digital distribution service. I think I can summarize this whole shebang by quoting this one comment. Number 1. I like the uninstaller. Number 2. Please add a feature to purchase and play EA games through Steam. Commenter Charlie Utter, I could not have said it better myself. In fact, I'd like to add a third point. Uninstalling Origin keeps Mass Effect 3 from clogging up my Steam list, so I can go back to pretending it never happened. Sorry, EA, but we're not going to let that one go. Second to last, apparently someone went and put a lot of retro Sega games on Steam without my knowledge for the past few years, and they recently released a Sega Genesis Classics Pack number 5. I didn't even know there were packs 1 through 4. Anyway, listen to these titles. Phantasy Star 2 through 4, Beyond Oasis, Dynamite Heady, Golden Axe 3, Streets of Rage 3, and several others, all for the low, low price of $7.50. Apparently, Phantasy Star 4, even selling by itself at $3, wound up in the top 10 bestsellers under $5. As someone on Penny Arcade succinctly put it, the audience for JRPGs on Steam is being drastically underestimated. You saw Ys, Oath and Fel'Ghana get the same treatment when it hit Steam. The Carpe Fulgar guys with Reseteer and Chantelis. We went over this before, but the Steam crowd just gobbles these things up, even for games that were released years ago. Now mind you, this is different from saying that Nintendo should put Pokemon on iOS platforms. Nintendo is still an active player in the industry. They can still make games for more than a dollar's worth of content. Sega, however, is out of the console manufacturing game. It has literally nothing to lose by opening up its back catalog and putting already developed games on Steam. These very often are games that were emulated years ago, and yet people buy them because, well, just because. It's cheap, it's convenient. If there is ever a Sega fire sale on their IPs, it will be a spectacle for the record books. If they somehow were to put Valkyria Chronicles on Steam for, I don't know, what, 10, 20 bucks? I know, that will never ever happen, but bear with me. If that did happen, I would be on my way to the first Chivo before Visa could record the transaction. That's the power of Steam, man. Serve the Newell and ye shall share in his bounty. And lastly, for your daily dose of insanity, we're gonna bring up Electronic Arts again, and Steam for that matter. IndieGamingMag.com reports that an EA indie bundle has appeared on Steam, containing the following games. Shank, Shank 2, Deathspank, Deathspank Thongs of Virtue, Warp, and Gatling Gears. Now these are legit independent titles, which is to say very small developers. They just happen to have Electronic Arts as publisher. So we have some kind of Schrodinger's bundle here, simultaneously indie and not indie. Of course, in my opinion, the weird part of it is that it's on Steam and not Origin. Gosh, EA, it's almost like you want the bundle to actually sell or something. Okay, I think that's about all I can take for one night. Thanks for listening, folks. For Random NPC, this is John. I'll see you next week.